Good afternoon and a very warm welcome to this Cheapside debate entitled Islam and Democracy, Are They Compatible? I'm the rector here. This debate's been some time in gestation and very much the genius of Amedy Turner, who's going to chair it. I very much regret that David Nordell is detained for personal reasons and unable to be with us this afternoon. And we are tremendously in the debt of Douglas Murray, who has stepped in at the very last minute and is going to speak today. Douglas is a journalist and commentator. His latest book, Neoconservatism, Why We Need It, is described by the historian Andrew Roberts as a book which shows us how to fight and to win the war on terror. And he is the director of the Centre for Social Cohesion in Westminster. We are very grateful to you. I first met Usama Hassan some years ago, about 10 years or more ago, when he came to address Christian clergy in the Hackney area about Islamic perceptions of Christianity. And that was long before my name, George Bush, and his first name, Osama, acquired their current resonance. And I now reckon that together we would be able to command a table in any restaurant in London at any time. Osama is a senior lecturer at London's Middlesex University and an expert on astronomical sciences. He's a part-time imam at the London Mosque, a member of the Islamic Society of Britain, and director of the City Circle. Amedy Turner, who, as I say, will chair today's debate, is Queen's Counsel and a former MEP, and he has brought a wealth of parliamentary and legal experience to the vexed question of whether there indeed does exist a clash of civilizations. And I'll leave it to him more closely to explain the project intended to bring together Muslims at grassroots to discuss perceptions of religion and democracy in particular. So over to you, Amedy.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm glad I'm not in the pulpit. I never have been in one, and I feel sorry for them who are. But of course, they are clerics and academics, and so it's where they expect to be. I'm an ordinary politician, so I'm down on the ground. If I did go into a pulpit with one of them, it would be that one. And because I think we're on the same side, but we'll know more about that later. This project was set up by the Advisory Council of the Anglican Observatory of the United Nations to find the views on democracy of Muslims living in the West, in Britain and America, because they know what democracy is like. They live with it. And I think that we think, that non-Muslims think, that democracy is at the central pillar of the West, probably our religion, although I ought not say that here, and our main ideal, though it's a very rough diamond. And so we decided to ask Muslims living here who also know democracy whether they thought it was compatible with Islam, and whether or not there would be, if they said no, the answer probably would be an inherent clash of civilizations. We put together 38 groups of Muslims living in Britain and America, 400 of them, in fact. They're all anonymous. They had to be promised that because they were reluctant, really, to give their views unless they were protected. And they each had three meetings lasting 2.5 hours, so there was 300 hours of discussion, which is a lot. And they wrote down all they wanted to about what they thought about democracy. It was a haphazard lot. Teachers and business people and professional people and students and their wives. Now, I've been around America just recently on this and noticing the difference between British Muslims and American ones. British Muslims are geared very well into politics. They're members of the House of Lords, House of Commons, and of course county councils. Muslim Americans, on the other hand, have no politics but are probably more integrated because of the melting pot effect of America. And it's interesting that they call themselves Muslim Americans, whereas here Muslims are called British Muslims. I think that means that in America, to be an American Muslim puts America first, and here, to be a British Muslim puts Britain, puts Islam first. And when the Church Times saw this, they said, well, they hope that British Christians also put Christianity before Britishness. I don't know if that was a sensible hope. So despite the differences between Muslims in the two countries, the views in this report, it's 100 pages long, it's everything, every single thing they said, the views in this report I find completely impossible to distinguish where they came from. I was in San Diego and making a quotation, and the next quotation came from South London and was almost identical. I hadn't noticed it till I read the two together. And so they do seem to have a single view about democracy, Muslims living in the West. They did not discuss their own position in a democracy, and they did not discuss any existing Muslim democracy. They only talked about democracy and Islam as two ideas. The first conclusion they came to was no one considered democracy to be an ideal or a principle. Nor do they consider it to be incompatible with Islam. I think the reason being that Islam is up here and democracy is down here, and they don't meet, and so there's no incompatibility. Islam is a perfect ideal, a principle. As one of them said, it's drawn down from heaven, and democracy is human created, evolving and earthly, and has no global or universal status. So the first conclusion was they did not think that democracy was incompatible with Islam. Of course, in the West, democracy is trusted because we've used it for a long time, and we live through landslides. I'm a politician. I've lived through a landslide. At least I think I lived through it. I didn't survive it. And we feel safe. But of course, in a new democracy, one's much more concerned with landslides, and 50-50 voting is much better. As in all the elections in the last 6 months, all over the world, in the new world, the voting in elections has been 50-50, resulting in coalition governments where all the parties are in, and everybody feels they own the government, and they own the parliament and the constitution. The views of Muslims on democracy in this report are in quite a narrow spectrum. As I say, it's not an ideal, and to them, the most favorable remark is that it's probably the best of a bad lot, which is precisely what Winston Churchill said. The worst of them said, it's bad and not for us, because it does not reflect people's views. So it's quite a narrow ambit. They have a cool view of democracy, but they think it probably is the best way to get government done. That is the general conclusion. There is one great exception, one great proviso. They said, democracy, yes, but nothing contrary to the Quran shall happen. Now, of course, that could be a matter of considerable significance. It's wholly logical to say that, because the Quran is undisputed. Unlike the Hadith and all, most of what we hear about Islam is not the Quran at all, it's the later developments. It's undisputed, and it is complete. Nothing is omitted from the book, it says. The book explains all things. And so it's very, very correct for them to say, democracy, yes, but nothing contrary to the Quran. And the extent that leads to exclusions from democracy is a matter for them to decide. We would say that some Western rights that women have would probably be not respected. We would say that some crimes are defined, though not many, in the Quran, which we would not agree with the definition, and some punishment. Although nearly all the punishment in the Quran is in fact not in this life, but in the next life. There's a great deal of threat of punishment, but it's all in the next life, and so that doesn't really concern us at the moment. My feeling is very strongly that they accept democracy, and we must accept the exceptions they feel they've got to make to it in order to comply with the Quran. The next speaker, who I think I would be standing next to if I was a pulpit man, which I'm not, and I'm pretty sure that that one I would not be standing next to in a pulpit. But we'll wait and see.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, all merciful, most merciful. Islam and democracy, are they compatible? When people ask me this question, usually it's phrased, is Islam compatible with democracy, often in the West? Because as our chair said to me before the talk, democracy is in a sense the religion of the West now. If it was put like that, I would rephrase it the other way around. For a believer, it is democracy compatible with Islam? And the answer is quite resoundingly yes. But we are talking about two very different things. Anybody who studies the Quran in a deep sense, and not in a superficial sense as presented on television last night, would know that from the second chapter of the Quran, for example, the longest chapter, Islam is the path to God, the path of submission, brought by all of the great prophets of God, beginning with Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Christ, peace be upon him, and finally the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. As the verse of the Quran says, truly religion with God is submission to his will. So that is what Islam means to me, certainly, as somebody brought up with the Quran and memorized it as a child and been studying it for the last 30 years. It is the path to God, which gives a sense of the sacred, imbues a sense of the sacred and God to everything we do. And democracy is a very effective and pragmatic way of organizing political life, public life, which has taken centuries, of course, perhaps 1,000 years in Britain, to develop and to come to in its different formats in the West. The Muslim countries, the Muslim lands, of course, have had a different trajectory, but they're also converging towards that path. Now, what do I mean by this? The most important principle in the Quran for political life is shura, which means consultation. As you will know, the Quran has 114 chapters, each one of which has a name. And one of those chapters is called shura, consultation. It is the core principle. In that chapter, we are told, وَأَمْرُهُمْ شُورَى بَيْنَهُمْ. Their matters, the matters of the believers, are decided by mutual consultation. So that really is the spirit. And what has happened throughout Islamic history is Muslims have been more interested in democracy, or the rule of law, ordered civilization, a society which functions well in harmony, and as always, is geared towards the worship of God. And the precise form it takes really doesn't matter. So for example, we begin with the ideal, which is the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, himself. Now he is given a choice in the revelation of being a prophet king or a servant and messenger. The prophet king is the model of David and Solomon in the Quran, rich and powerful. But the higher model is that of Moses, Jesus, Christ, and the prophet himself, which is slave and messenger of God, where actually political power is there also, the leader of the community. As with Moses, the prophet is a powerful leader, and his nation, his armies, defeat the two superpowers of his time very easily. But he is actually not interested. So when he's given the choice between prophet, king, and servant and messenger of God, he chooses the latter. And that is actually very important towards understanding how Muslims have looked upon political power ever since. And I may add here, this is very similar in Western thought to say, Plato, which some Muslim authorities would regard as having had access to revelation from God, because the Quran says that every nation in the East and West received revelation from God and had prophets come to them. So when Plato talked about the philosopher king, of course, being the ideal, and of course he spoke of societies degrading through aristocracy, oligarchy, democracy, eventually to democracy, which he regarded as a kind of mob rule. For many people in the Muslim world, the idea was very similar. Now, after the Prophet, peace be upon him, passed away, there were the crises of leadership. Now, the man who received direct revelation from God to order the community's affairs had gone. What happened was the system of caliphate was arrived at through consensus in a democratic way, if you like. Abu Bakr was elected the first caliph by a meeting of the leaders of the communities. After Abu Bakr passed away, he nominated before his death the next caliph, Omar. And this may seem like monarchic succession, but crucially it wasn't, as all of the Muslim theologians and jurists have argued. Omar's appointment was only valid when the community gave him the Pledge of Allegiance, Bayah, and unanimously accepted him as a second caliph. Omar was assassinated after 13 years of rule. And after that, there was a real crisis, and the community split into the two camps of Uthman and Ali. And eventually, these two were the last two candidates for the position of caliphate. Omar had actually appointed these two, as well as four others, into a council of six. And he had said, the next caliph should be amongst these six. They are the leaders of the community. He had also included his own son, Abdullah, as an advisor to that group of six, but said, under no condition must my son be given power. That was how scrupulous Omar was. And we know from history, of those six, four of them abdicated or pulled out in favor of their chosen candidate, if you like, and we were left with Uthman and Ali. And other leaders of the community, like Abdurrahman bin Auf, it is recorded again in the Hadith tradition, knocked on every single door in Medina, which was the capital of the empire, if you like, to decide people's views, to ascertain people's views before Uthman was given the caliphate. Again, he ruled for 10 to 13 years. He was assassinated also. And the people naturally turned to the only leader that was left, who was Ali, the Prophet's cousin and son-in-law. And he was elected the caliph. He had a turbulent 4 years of rule, and he was assassinated also. But those four, the first four caliphs, are called the righteous caliphs. And Muslims will still look to those four, and they encompass both the Shia and Sunni perspectives on faith and political power as the ideal. And it's very easy to argue, you see, all four of them were elected or selected in very different ways. And again, this shows that Muslims were interested in stability and the rule of law and the rule of sacred law, and the fact that they would have the freedom and the opportunity to worship God in so many different ways, prayer, fasting, serving the community, etc. And that's why we see a certain diffidence, if you like, towards political events. So most of the history of Islam from then on is one of dynasties, monarchs, etc. And even now you have this approach to power. I talk to people in Saudi Arabia, and they say, well, we just follow the leader. I saw a CNN interview with a young man in Dubai recently who was asked, are you not worried that you don't have the vote? And he said, well, nobody's complaining here. Because actually, those societies are actually very wealthy and people are well off, so they don't really mind. But in other places where things are much harder, there is a huge campaign amongst the Muslim masses, of course, for democracy. Countries like Egypt, Turkey, Pakistan, and across the Muslim world, in fact, Algeria and Morocco and other places, there are many, many committed Muslim Democrats. And I should add really here that we have to look at trajectories. The Western world has taken centuries, also through monarchs and kings and lots of civil war, to get to the sophisticated forms of democracy here. The Muslim world is actually in a transition phase, perhaps arriving at something similar. But we have to take specifics of the situation into account. So, for example, in Pakistan, as Professor Zia Sardar repeatedly says, the social situation, if you like, in Pakistan is based on a feudal system, a medieval feudal system. And a lot of this talk of democracy is almost irrelevant, in fact. And we've seen that whenever we've had elected civilian leaders in Pakistan, democratic leaders, the army has been able to move in whenever it wishes, because civil society is not strong in Pakistan, because you still have this feudal system where the landowners have what they call vote banks, but they really are, they command their serfs. So there are all kinds of problems in trying to transplant a system of government or organizing the public, which has taken, as I said, centuries to involve here in the West, and to transplant it into Muslim countries without giving them an opportunity to develop that organically. But as I said, this has happened in Turkey, in Egypt, where we were last week. And in fact, it is a complaint of Muslim masses around the world that Western governments preach freedom and democracy everywhere, but yet have consistently supported some of the most cruel despots and tyrants in the Muslim world, and in fact helped to install them in the first place. So Saddam Hussein came to power with the help of a CIA coup, Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, and many other such rulers across the Muslim world are still there because of that. And that is obviously for wider political and, if you like, materialistic interests. I would just like to close with the idea that as Muslims, I think, and Western Muslims like myself and some of us in the audience, we have a foot in both East and West, in both Islam and what's called the West, and I think we are well placed to criticize both. I remember reading from one of our traditional scholars, Abu Ja'far al-Kattani, who was a 20th century hadith scholar, and he wrote, at his time there were calls for democracy in Syria and in Egypt. And after decades of thinking about it, or years of thinking about it, he actually said, you know what? He said, democracy suits the condition of the people, and so let them have democracy. What he actually meant was that there had been a lack of respect, a lack of deference, the abandonment of the idea that that we trust our leaders, we elect and select the best leaders we have, and we let them get on with their job. And the idea of consultation is that leaders consult whoever is most qualified. So, for example, I don't know very much about the National Health Service or about how to run the economic world. I don't know too much about economics or the National Health Service. We have problems with the economy. We have problems with the National Health Service in this country. I would say you ask the experts in that area to come up with solutions. And that is, if you like, a very obvious and pragmatic way to look at the situation. I do think there are problems with democracy. There are many different forms of democracy in the West, of course, and both of them have become ideals, Islam and democracy, and we're very far away from both, if you like. We are a far cry from the city-states of ancient Greece, where every citizen was able to take part in the public affairs of their life, especially in London. We have very little time, those of us who commute to work and have several jobs and trying to raise a family also, to actually take part in community councils or in local government or politics. And our local government and our national government political systems tend to be dominated by small groups of activists. And I think the 40% no showing in the last general election is a symptom of this, that many people in this country are actually apathetic and tired of our politicians. Because of the system, many of our politicians are forced to make short-term decisions for the sake of winning the next election, for the sake of getting the votes. I think we do suffer from serious short-termism in this country, which is affecting key aspects of policy and society in our country right now. Also, the lack of respect, which Tony Blair talked about famously some years ago, leading to increased crime, etc. But we've gone from one extreme of excessive deference to the other extreme of a lack of respect, often a total lack of respect in key aspects of our society. And part of it, I think, is the idea that, well, everybody is equal, one man, one vote, and everybody's entitled to their own opinion, no matter how ignorant or ill-informed a person can be. I think a balanced way is, as we argue for in Muslim countries, yes, we have one man, one vote, but we still honor our parents, we honor our elders, people of wisdom and experience. We don't forget the layers of society, age, experience, wisdom, if you like. All of these are very important God-given qualities. And certainly, people like myself and others find no contradiction between Islam and democracy. What we're really trying to do is work out the details where they meet and live as authentic Muslims in democratic societies, where the principle of consultation, mutual consultation amongst ourselves, is the key to living our lives, shura, and most importantly, the purpose for which all of this is there. There's no point in having well-ordered democratic societies if we lose our sense of God and the sacred, and that is in the end the final goal. To God is the end of all affairs. Thanks very much.
Thank you. First of all, should say it's a great pleasure to be here and to be able to replace, at very short notice, David Nordell. Sorry, couldn't be here. I regret that the chair assumed I was going to indulge in saying that Islam and democracy are not compatible. I actually have very many times and continue to say that they are compatible, but I would take issue with a certain amount of what Osama Hassan has said. One of the problems of posing the question of whether or not Islam and democracy are compatible is it is one of those unfair questions, because the answer has to be yes. If the answer is not yes, we're in trouble. If the answer is not yes, we're in trouble here in Britain, because a lot of Muslims, devout, observant Muslims, as well as cultural Muslims, would help us be in trouble. We'd be in trouble in the Middle East. We'd be in trouble across the Muslim cultural world. When Osama Hassan refers to the flaws of democracy, I should say immediately that as a fervent admirer of democracy, though not, I should add, a worshipper of it, I don't think you find any worshippers of democracy, one of the important differences. One of the things that any admirer and advocate of democracy has is the opposite of the religious instinct, which believes in the immutability and perfection of texts and of ideas, and recognizes the innate flaws of democracy. It's in recognizing the flaws of democracy that you have a proper democracy. It's in knowing that you're at risk of minority interest groups that you resist being manipulated by minority interest groups. It's actually what you cite, Osama, the one man, one vote issue, is, and the equality of all voters, is to my mind one of the very finest things about democracy. And actually in ancient Greece, of course, you didn't have equal voting rights at all. Women, for instance, certainly weren't able to come before the chamber in Athens and have the same voting rights as men. But I think the one man, one vote thing is one of the great advantages, something which religious advocates will not agree with on this, but learning itself, it seems to me, and this is not enough. The reason why I admire democracy is because I know how little I admire intellectual elites. It's because I know how little you can trust very clever people, how very often the stupidest thing that you will hear said will be said by a high-ranking philosopher, or, may I say, archbishop. This is part of the advantage of it. It's a great leveling process where everyone with innate common sense can have their say, have their vote. You mention also apathy, voter apathy. Nobody would deny there's large voter apathy, but do, might I remind you, look at some of the possible reasons for that. A lot of people don't turn out for elections now, and I think are perfectly within their rights not to, not because they don't believe in democracy, but because they believe that there's very little difference between the political parties, and that's the case, because in this democracy, most of the major issues have been settled. We had the issue throughout the Cold War of whether the free market state would thrive or whether collectivism, whether socialism would be the answer to that. That battle has been won, not for all time. Nothing's ever won for all time in democracy. But for the time being, that issue has been closed. We no longer have the option between the horrible worldview of Mr. Benn and Mr. Scargill and that of Mrs. Thatcher. It's much less clean-cut. That's, I'd say, the problem. That's not a problem of democracy. Apathy is not democracy's problem. It's a symptom of its success. On the issue of Islam and democracy, I would quickly refer to, before listing some of the, may I say, hurdles, at the very least, that Islam has in this issue. I would just tell you a very quick story about a few months ago, the literalist, fundamentalist Christian, Pat Robertson. I was asked to do a spot for a television documentary from America. I agreed. Just before going in to do the thing, they came to my office. One of my colleagues said, "Oh my gosh, this television channel is owned by Pat Robertson. Are you going to do it?" Well, I said, "Well, I suppose so. Still say my bit." And one of the most interesting things was that his interviewer said various things. It was about Islam. And he said, "And what do you think, Mr. Murray, is the solution to the problem of Islam?" And I said, "Well, I think they have to do the same thing that you did. I think they have to drop belief in the literalness of texts, drop texts and verses they don't agree with, believe that you can do a bit of a pick-and-mix exercise with your allegedly holy books. There was a terrific pause after this, and this man said, could we do that bit again? But this is a serious issue for Islam, because Islam has a lot of the problems, which some of which are unique to Islam, some of which are very comparable with problems that both the two other major monotheisms and indeed the other major world religions have gone through. It has to answer certain questions. It has to get over certain problems. It took a long time, I'd be the first to admit, it took a long time for Christianity to get over certain of its problems. It took great men, it took brave men. It took men like Galileo and Spinoza to help us, individuals who paved the way for the current state we have. But I would cite, first of all, as one of the hurdles that Islam has to get over if it's going to be fully compatible with a democracy, would be the separation of church and state. It might sound like an ironic thing to argue for in a Church of England church, but in real terms, although the Church of England remains connected centrally to the state, in real terms, if the Queen did want to assert her power as the nominal head of the Church of England and really wanted to go for it in a purge of Catholics or something, this wouldn't happen. We know the nominal nature of it. This is one of the most important states you can get to in a democracy, is that theocrats and religious people do not have the central controlling government and use their religion as a way to control the people in that state. I'd also cite as a very obvious case the role of women, and I'm sure we can go into that if you like. We'd need to see Islam get over its problem with women. We'd need to see Islam get over its problem, which is very practically and frequently demonstrated across the world at the moment, with various minorities. We'd have to see Islam, among other things, respecting minorities within its own faith. If you know what the apostasy rules that are currently trying to be pushed through in Iran, this means that not just Baha'is and other faiths in Iran, but sects of Islam which are not compatible with the theocratic Shiism of the ruling regime would be punishable, indeed even still punishable by death. We'd have to see Islam granting equal rights to all sorts of people, all sorts of minorities. Incidentally, you note, I hope, that I didn't mention women among minorities. It's one of the most glaring, irritating things in this area. But we would have to see Islam respecting the rights of homosexuals. We'd also have to see Islam recognizing the rights of apostates, of people who might have been born to Muslim parents. After all, there's no such thing as a Muslim child any more than there is a Christian child. The child of Christian parents, the child of Muslim parents. But children are not born Muslim. The idea that you would exercise, because they were born of Muslim parents, say that they had a duty throughout the rest of their lives to be subjected to forms of law, specifically Sharia, because they've been born that way, is, I think, a disgusting notion, and one which we'd have to see overthrown in the world of Islam. I'd also cite that the fact that Islam has to understand freedom of expression, something, again, I concede, took us a very long time in the West to get to. The fact that it is not just a right, but a duty to offend people in free and democratic societies, particularly when you are talking about truths, demonstrable truths, observable truths, and so on. You would also, finally, I would list in here, have to see Islam respecting the notion of a free judiciary, one which did not draw its legal instincts from allegedly holy books. We would have to see the Sharia as not being the vital element of law in those societies. The ECHR described Sharia a few years ago as being absolutely incompatible, was the word, incompatible with democracy. And I think that's right. Democracy, after all, is human created. It's true. It is human created, as is, I would argue, Islam, as is religion. Islam was created by a human being, and democracy is created by human beings. I don't think it is divine. And I think the notion that what we see here is a standoff between the numinous and the earthly is the wrong way to look at this. I would repeat something I alluded to earlier about freedom of expression and particularly apostasy on this. Because when you heard in the introduction about the views of Muslims and the undisputed nature of their texts, I would say that one of the reasons why the Muslim world and certain theocrats fear democracy so much is because democracy and free expression involves things like open scholarship, free inquiry. Free expression is just the most visible end of it. But how many Muslims in the Muslim world know, for instance, which variants of the Quran they use, or that there are variants? That the Quran is not an immutable book, that it is not an uncreated text, that there are variants used within the Muslim world. That a few years ago, when in the Yemen, some very early pre-10th century Qurans were dug up, and Channel 4 was going to do a documentary about this extraordinary discovery, akin to the discovery of the scrolls at Qumran. Instead of, as at Qumran, people becoming aware of these texts, the whole thing was shut up. Channel 4 didn't do the documentary. Nobody would. Why? Because these Qurans are variants of the allegedly immutable Quran that exists, i.e. Quranic scholarship hasn't even begun, hasn't even got to a stage which Christian and Judaic scholarship was at centuries ago. That would be the sort of thing which in a democracy you should be able to study, talk about, dispute, argue, all of these things. Something which Islam in its current phase is not just exceedingly bad at, but I would argue uniquely bad at. Democracy is not a religion, it's a laws in which man governs man. The best state I think you could have, the best state for justice, where laws are made by man for man, not derived from holy texts, not derived from holy texts in which you don't have a say if you don't believe in them. Where if you're a young girl born into a Muslim country and you're told you will be ruled this way because it says this in this book, I don't believe it, doesn't matter. I claim divine origin for this book and you'll have to be ruled by it. That's a serious problem which will have to be got over. Look, in winding up, I would cite the success stories of Islam and democracy in recent years. The success of Afghanistan and Iraq's constitutions, attempts, very, very bitter and difficult attempts, to bring secularism, which is not state atheism, but secularism, the belief that people in Afghanistan and Iraq will be ruled by laws created by Afghanis and Iraqis, that women will have rights. All these things that have been very hard and hard fought for in the constitutions of both those countries will, if they succeed, be leading the way, I believe, throughout the Muslim world. The fight in Iraq and Afghanistan is for secularism, not for atheism, but for secularism, where our secular allies are fighting and dying every day in order to bring this. And why is that so important? It's because in a country like Iraq, it is the only solution that it is a democracy which is secular. It is the only solution because in a country with the number and variants of different tribes and groups in it, you cannot have it run by a tribe or a group that claims divine origins for texts and unique interpretations of texts. They will spend their time subjugating those who do not agree with them. We know the problem in the Middle East, the practical problem of voting. Democracy is more than voting. I'm the first to admit that. Democracy is more than voting. It's more than voting when in a country like Egypt, if you had a free vote, which I very much hope happens soon, you would at the moment be voting in the Muslim Brotherhood. Just as the people of the Gaza voted in the Hamas. That is one of the great dangers. But you know, we have to say in that democracy is more than voting. It is not appropriate just to say one vote once. Or as the Communist Party in Ukraine put it in their election a few years ago, vote for us and never vote again. I think they got about 12 votes. Turkey, of course, promises us one of the ways out of this, that the people of Turkey can be observant Muslims, devout Muslims, or non-devout Muslims, cultural Muslims, whatever they want to be. But that their democracy and their secular democracy could be so strong, this incredibly admirable system, I think, so strong that it could even take its ruling party to court. I don't even think another secular democracy like France would do that. I think it's a tremendous demonstration of what can be achieved in the melding of democracy and Islam. And finally, Azama Hassan said that Muslims in this country have a foot in the East and a foot in the West. I don't think you should have. I don't think you should have at all. Not because I'm going to criticize you for dual loyalties or anything like that. It's for this reason, Azaman.
It's that to make that claim is to make one fundamental misunderstanding, which many people on my side have made very regularly. But it's to make the fundamental misunderstanding and to give to your enemies and mine one of the most terrible preconceptions, and it's one we should correct today, which is that democracy is not a Western value. Democracy, secularism, the right to be judged by men and to work with men and not with gods, is a universal value, not a Western one.
Thank you very much. Well, now we've got 10 minutes for questions or statements. Who'd like to make a provocative statement? Oh, yes. Yes.
So I am Dr. Khan, and I come from Pakistan. A professor in one of the universities in Pakistan, and currently I am working here at RUSI. It's a think tank for security and defense studies, Whitehall, London. So I think it's a reality that we are living in a global village, and we are all the citizens of a global village. Therefore, if any corner of this village is disturbed, it carries repercussions for the entire village and all the citizens. Therefore, I think it's high time we all, the residents of this global village, we should collectively approach to the problems. Collective wisdom, I think that's need of the time. Secondly, in this state of affairs, I think dialogue, intra-nation dialogue, is very, very important, because sometimes we there are differences in our thoughts. So we sometimes make mistakes about each other, and someone has remarked that the real tragedy is a conflict between right and right. Then if I like to make comment about Islam and the Muslims. So you all know that Islam is a religion. Islam is a deen, a social order. The Muslims, the followers of Islam. Sometimes the fault or the faults lies with the Muslims. But I am sorry to say, in this case, we are going to criticize Islam. I think we should criticize the Muslims where the fault or the fault lies. Then, what is the meaning of Islam? Literally, if you look at the term Islam, it means peace and stability. Then in the Western, I'm sorry to say, that the people, they are going to say Islamic terrorism, Islamic militancy. No, I think if you will say Muslim terrorists or the Muslim militancy, it's okay, but you are going to blame Islam. Then democracy. I think it's very, very, you could say, attractive system of political system. But there are, democracy also needs some things. For instance, if they look at your literacy rate and the poor countries, your literacy rate, your per capita income, your institutions, I think if you give per capita income, for instance, to the citizens of Pakistan, if you give them political stability, economic prosperity, strengthen institutions, then you will see what type of democracy they are establishing in Pakistan. Let me remind you, our last February elections, in spite of political troubles,
I think we have to wind up now, because there's somebody behind you who wants to say something too.
Yeah.
If you don't mind.
There is a problem? So, yeah, in spite of heavy political problems, what were the results of the elections? I think the people, they have chosen their representatives. So I think these are very, very important things, intra-nation dialogues and knowing about each other. So I think my point is, there are poor nations on the surface of this world.
Hand the torch to that fellow just behind you.
Yeah.
Yes, he wants to say something.
Thank you. I'd like to invite the two speakers to reflect on what I'm going to say. I'm here as a self-appointed spokesperson on behalf of future generations. The most critical issue facing the world now is the most serious issue that has ever faced the world, namely climate change. It's all very well to have religious principles or humanist principles or to subscribe to democratic principles. The reality is what happens when you have to put them into practice. And here we are in a world in which we are ignoring the consequences of the fact.
Thank you very much. That's an extremely important point for another meeting, I think. Now, who else would like to say something about Islam? Yes.
Thank you. My name is Shahwar Sadek. I've been in Britain for 45 years, and yes, I'm a Muslim woman. I quite agree with most of the things you've said, because I have been able to practice it as a Muslim in a democratic Britain. Where, may I ask you, have we as voters accepted homosexuality as being right? You say these are the things that Islam stands against. So that is one question. And the position of women in Islam is cited again and again as being a negative. There are so many positives about women in Islam which are never upheld by people who say Islam is not a democratic religion. And the other one is, you talked about Sharia and democracy not being compatible. Both Lord Phillips, Lord Chancellor, and the Archbishop of Canterbury have said, perhaps we do look at it. Thank you very much.
Next question, yes.
My name's Alan Rayner. I'm doing a doctorate, just finishing it. I've been in a Sufi group for 3 years, an Orthodox synagogue for 3 years, and a Hindu temple for 3 years, and I've been members of interfaith organizations for 30 years. And I do believe, quite sincerely, that living with a Hindu temple where a child of three can sit cross-legged and listen with absolute attention, and I've been 80 classes in England, 80 different schools, where you can't get kids quiet in 20 minutes, that we have a lot to learn from our other friends about the real benefit of true religion passed down. Why did that child sit so still? Because they've been doing it for 3,000 years. And in the Orthodox synagogue, the respect they have for each other and the trust, which is why the Jews are so good commercially around the world, because they can trust each other with diamonds and the valuation of diamonds. And when it comes to the scriptures, they are inspired. You know, if you think of the Beatitudes, no political party would win on the Beatitudes. But the whole world would win if we all obeyed the Beatitudes. And the first of them, is just pure humility. If you don't start with that, there's nothing else.
Thank you very much. So, next one. Yes, Ahmed.
Yes, Maria Almendra McBride. I live here in the UK. I was born in Mexico. I thank God that I'm in Britain. It has been such a wonderful place to learn about democracy, about freedom, about justice, about education and communication. One thing as a Catholic, as I was brought up, although my father was Protestant from the High Church of Scotland, and my best friends are Jewish, I would like to say that it's something that as Catholics we're brought up with the notion. We are all brothers and sisters living in the one planet, one world, which as you rightly say, it's very finite resource world. So that is my thought. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Time for one more. We stop at 2:05 because you've all got to rush back to your city offices, but looking at you, I don't think many of you have got to.
Barbara Zollner, Dr. Barbara Zollner from Birkbeck College. Thank you for both speakers. I have a comment to make on your presentation, Mr. Turner, and this is about your constant use of Islam or your reference to Islam. I agree with the first speaker insofar as there is not such a thing as a monolithic Islam. There are so many contributions by Muslims, and many Muslims do have a very open attitude towards democracy. And therefore, I think to refer to Islam in a very monolithic way would be just maybe a little bit incorrect.
Time for another? Yes, back there.
Hello, everybody. My name is Hassan Salimi. I just work around the corner. I'm also a member of the City Muslims organization. I agree with most of what Osama said, naturally, because I'm a Muslim as well. But I would say about my friend on the right that this is very typical of the list of or the criteria that's demanded for Muslims to meet to be truly described as democratic. The list is so long and so expansive beyond simple democracy. And riddled with so many assumptions and false assumptions about Islam, not Muslims, but about Islam, that the proponents of democracy in the Muslim world end up putting Muslims off that argument, and it's counterproductive. Because when you're asking Muslims to accept the Quran is not immutable or divine, and there are variant traditions, I'm aware of the Yemen manuscripts, and it's not as my friend has portrayed, actually, but that's for me as a Muslim to believe. When you're asking for me to accept that the Quran is not immutable, and is man-made as well, you're asking the impossible. You're almost, from a Muslim point of view, you're asking the Muslim world at least the political elites to become apostates as a condition to accept true democracy or full democracy. I know that's not literally what you're asking, but it's implicit within what you're saying. And this is the problem with crusaders for democracy. I hate to use that word, I'm sorry. But you end up putting people off democracy and not encouraging them or making them warm to the idea of representative government, which actually, as Osama said, existed from the very beginnings of Islam. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm very glad that you accepted my proposal that democracy is for Muslims, yes, but with exceptions which they must apply because of their religion, and that we in the West should accept those exceptions. Yes. Time for one more? Oh, sorry, you were first. I'm sorry. Yes.
Abdelkrim Khalil from the Muslim Cultural Heritage Center in West London. I thank both speakers for their contributions. Just one point, actually. I sensed from your presentation that you have obviously a problem with divine revelations. You want to rule that out from, you want us to, human beings, to just. You manage ourselves without actually any divine intervention. Now, I want to put to you that 1.6 billion people believe that one revelation has been preserved, intact, it's from God, and God knows best, and it is actually, we're happy to be guided by it. Now, I would like to hear any argument to actually to discredit that revelation historically or by in content or whatever way you want it. So far, I'm not aware of any academic or any political or religious argument to actually to discredit that revelation. And if that is the case, I don't know why we humans cannot actually live unguided by that revelation from the one who created us and knows best. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm afraid we can't. No, even I can't come in.
I think they can probably respond briefly.
A couple of minutes each. Yes, all right, you first.
Sorry, Father George, can I say with respect, the gentleman at the end had his hand up for a very long time. Could we take a very quick question from him, if you don't mind?
Yes.
Thanks.
My name's Ian Holford. I'm a PhD of Imperial College London and a student of Islam for a number of years. One of the gentlemen said that Islam means peace and stability. If this is the case, Islam has been very unsuccessful in establishing peace and stability because the majority of Islamic countries are very violent and unstable. I'd also suggest that there's no true democracy in any Islamic country, because in all Islamic countries you get persecution of minority groups, even in Turkey. So there's no indication from the way the world is that Islam is compatible with democracy.
Thank you. 2 minutes each.
Thank you. Well, it's quite a list, and it has confirmed an adage of mine that you can never go to any event without having, well, on any subject, without having one person who asks a question about global warming. Which, to my mind, incidentally, I don't deny it occurs, but I would just say that it's religious connotations these days. It's even indulgence like carbon offsettings do remind me that human beings are so susceptible to this stuff. When it comes along in a climate form, they'll grab that one too. Innate human wickedness. Travel down the street and you're destroying something. I would just answer very quickly a couple of questions that came up. I don't advocate, contra what Hassan Siddiqui said, that Muslims have to become apostates. And I certainly don't think that what I'm advocating is going to happen overnight or in a few years. It will happen, though. It will happen in the next few hundred years, long after the lifetime of anyone here. It will happen. Because you can't stop learning. Because you can't stop education. You can't stop people speaking out. And for one person who speaks out and says, come on, this idea is so ridiculous, a cat would laugh at it. 10 people will hear it. 100 people will hear it. You can't keep down truths by theocratic means forever. The history of the world has shown this. The history of the West, the current history of the Muslim world. The lady, incidentally, who said that I'd said it was, Islam was monolithic, I hope I didn't give that impression. I talked, apart from anything else, about the minorities of Islam within Islam, but it's a perennial problem, and I hope you concede that I wasn't saying that Islam is or was one thing. The lady who referred to the role of women in Islam and of homosexuality, I have to say, your history of the laws on homosexuality in this country would be begging a revision, I think, if you look at the way in which elected democratic governments in this country commissioned, not least the Wolfenden report and other reports which made homosexuality not illegal, you would see that those governments had democratic mandates to do so. You may disagree with them, you may rejoice in the idea that at some point in the future you may be able to re-illegalize homosexuality. I would say that at that point we could have a debate and that I would trust that I would win it. The idea, you say that women in Islam are always being portrayed negatively? No, of course they're not. There are many good things, many happy women in Islam. I don't dispute that at all. But I would wonder why the ire of women who say how wonderful life is in Islam are not citing the two women killed on Saturday night by the Taliban in Afghanistan. Why the execution of young gay men in Iran, hanging young gay men from cranes at the age of 16, isn't cited by these people who tell us how wonderfully tolerant Islam is? Why don't we hear more voices condemning that from within the Islamic world? Why don't we hear demonstrations? Why weren't you all demonstrating, every single Muslim in Britain, against the two women executed on Saturday night? You didn't. The silence is deafening. Finally, I'd say that on that same point, this is not a Muslim-imposed point or point imposed on Muslims. Poland, with its extraordinarily regressive and bigoted laws on homosexuality and the opinions of its observers, is being castigated by the EU for those things, and its entry and its membership is much compromised by them not observing that. I'd finally say, on the issue of Sharia and revelation, no, I think the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Lord Chief Justice have defamed the traditions, legal traditions, and others of this country by their ridiculously uninformed comments. The Archbishop of Canterbury said that it was terrible and would deeply worrying that everyone would be treated by the same rule of law. No, that's the point. Equality before the law. That's why so many people come to this country, because they have equal rights, whoever they are, however poor, however rich, they are treated equally before the law. That's a great advantage. The Archbishop seems not to think so. I'm sorry he's in his position and hasn't resigned. Finally, revelation. No, I don't believe it happens. I don't believe that the gentleman there, that archangels intermittently descend to earth and dictate or redictate bits of old folk tales to tradesmen. I don't think that bits of the Quran, bits of the Old Testament were redictated to Muhammad in the 7th century, badly plagiarized. I don't think it happened. And I think that we're perfectly happy and perfectly capable to survive as a species, knowing that we are ourselves and we rely on ourselves and we can do, and that we don't have to go back to holy books so ridiculous that any child can, and they always do, point out their inconsistencies. Read a few books of the Quran and you'll see, just as you will from reading Leviticus or any number of other sacred texts, how ridiculous they are.
Thank you. And thank you for coming at such short notice, too.
Okay, first I'd like to thank people for time I didn't do earlier. I'd like to thank Father George Bush and Mr. Turner, everybody else for inviting us. I'd like to thank Douglas for some very interesting points and to all of you for your questions. Very briefly, I just wish we had more time to continue this. As you know, I've been declared an apostate myself and have a death sentence on me for saying that we mustn't kill apostates. The classic law on execution of apostates is not in the Quran. And myself and others have been very open about that. And the other reason for people declaring me apostate, I argued for what I call an Islamic secularism. And I would agree in a sense, on a pragmatic sense, a separation of church and state. Although that's very far from the ideal. The ideal is very close. It's clear in our head that the community is the state and it is a believing community. But being a scientist and worked in industry and also having had a theological training, I know that you don't want theologians running the industry and the economy and the National Health Service and everything else, like we've had in Iran and Afghanistan and other places. So I know these things. And we are pushing these arguments, as many thinkers across the Muslim world have been doing for decades, in fact. You know, talking about Islamic democracy, before that they were talking about Islamic socialism, I suppose, but Islamic democracy, or you might call it a sacred democracy or a theodemocracy. And the point is, I'm not too worried about the labels. It is very much about how we live our lives, given eternal principles revealed by God. But as a scientist, I'd like to see those old copies of the Quran subject to radioactive carbon dating, for example. I really have no problem with that. And the last night's program, I gave the director, Anthony Thomas, an hour and a half long interview answering every single one of Luxembourg's points, because they really are so superficial and so pathetic to anybody who studied the Quran and its history. However, that wasn't included, unfortunately. About Sharia, about women's rights, all of these issues, these are ongoing issues. Sharia, for example, I actually agree with you. I disagreed with the Archbishop's statement, and I think he did get it wrong. The great thinkers of Islamic law, Imam Ghazali, Ibn Taymiyyah, Shatibi, they arrived at the philosophy, a universal philosophy of law, Sharia, 6 centuries before John Locke said the same thing here in England. I'm very proud of that. However, I also recognize that even though the Muslim civilization was far advanced for 1,000 years while Europe was in the Dark Ages, obviously the Muslims lost it at some point in history, and the Muslim world is now far behind the West. Now, there has been colonialism over the last few centuries. There are a number of reasons, but we can continue that discussion and learn from each other. Because as you said, democracy, I also believe Islam is universal for East and West, as it says in the Quran. It's the light of God for East and West. It's a submission to God's will. And finally, I would just like to disagree with respect, sir, about most Muslim countries being violent. They're not. You go to Muslim countries, you have very loving society. The vast majority of people all around the world live in peace and they want to live with their neighbors. I would argue London is a very violent place, increasingly more so at the moment. We really mustn't judge countries with tens of millions of people, hundreds of millions of people, by a few headlines of violence here and there. The vast majority of the world, I would argue, is very peaceful. The problem we've had is materialism, a financial world financial system based on usury. Some people's supremacists in their ideology, in fact, which leads to wars and invasions for the sake of oil and for the sake of the other precious natural resources, which is all linked to the crisis of the earth and climate change, etc. You know, those are amongst the many factors which cause conflict in the world. But, you know, the vast majority of human beings are, as God created us, decent, just trying to get on with their lives and do a good job. And all of us have to, work hard to continue this dialogue and to build those bridges and not to increase the conflict and hatred in the world. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much for coming, everybody. And there is a note at the back or somewhere about this report. If you want to have it, you can get it on the website. Oh, it's just at the back there by the door. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you so much. Excellent. Really good.
No, really good.